Ben Moore has been in love with bees for as long as anyone can remember. And as far as we can tell, the feeling is entirely mutual. Although he still sometimes feels the sting of his passion. Hang around, learn a little. It's as sweet as honey and always a buzz. It's the Ultimate Pollinators Podcast with Ben, his friends and associates, and of course, Ben's bees.
Hey everyone, Bees with Ben. I just got to say, I am super, super excited doing this podcast. Absolutely love it. So hopefully you, the listener, loves it as well, because I'm lucky, and I'm sure everyone else is as well, listening to some awesome people. Now, we have a really cool episode on this week, and we've got Chris. Now, we had Chris back in episode 94, and Chris has just come back only a couple of weeks ago, and he's settled back in, being over to the west side of Africa, being Ghana and Guinea. So we're going to hear all about his travels and everything. So really cool episode, and I hope you enjoyed this one just as much as me. Awesome. I'm super excited. We got Chris again. Chris was episode 94. And since then, Chris has been abroad again. And I'm so jealous and so excited to talk to Chris. Thank you so much, Chris.
Yeah, no problem.
we've got this on YouTube as well. And Chris has that awesome African attire. Now, what's the name of that attire you're wearing, Chris?
Oh, now you're challenging me. There's definitely a specific name for this. This is a Ghanaian smock, but I don't remember what it is.
Ghanaian smock. I like that. That's good. That's absolutely awesome. So fantastic. Thank you so much for your time once again. Now, tell us, you've been abroad a couple of weeks ago, a few weeks back. Tell us, where did you go?
Yeah, so first I went to Ghana for 3 weeks, and then I was in Guinea for 2.5 weeks. Both of them are on the bulge of Western Africa.
Western Africa, awesome. So you arrived into Ghana, and you got off the plane. What happened? Tell us all. We want to hear all about it.
Well, I mean, nothing really dramatic, except it was interesting because I used to go to Africa like twice a year, and now I hadn't been there in 6 years. Before COVID, I hadn't been to Africa recently. So it was just exciting to be back there. And this was my first time in Ghana. And so I remember when I first arrived, I remember thinking, like, I have big associations for myself in Nigeria, in Guinea, both places I've been to multiple times. And as I arrived in Ghana, I was thinking to myself, like, is there room in my heart to love another country? Like, what is, you know, I knew that arriving, I was a blank slate for Ghana. And it's just kind of funny to think about, like, you know, in a few weeks, this slate's going to be all filled in, and how's it going to be? And then kind of you can contrast that with, so I was in Ghana for 3 weeks. Then I flew to Guinea, but then I'd have to go back to Ghana anyway. So I flew back to Ghana, and I was in Ghana for about 24 hours before I continued onward back to Australia. And that second arrival in Ghana, when I was coming back from Guinea, you know, in contrast from it being a blank slate, it was more like, oh, I'm coming home. Because, like, Nigeria is a bit unstable, kind of unsafe and wild in a lot of places. I don't want to offend any Nigerians, but it's a bit wild. And Guinea's very undeveloped. And so compared to my other two West African places I'm familiar with, arriving in Ghana, it's very developed and safe and kind of comfortable. So it was definitely like, back home in Ghana.
Love it. That's awesome. Now let's go back a step, because people would be interested to know. So flying from Melbourne to Ghana, how does one get there via plane? Like, what's the stopovers?
I usually Dubai. And getting to Ghana is pretty easy because there's lots of flights to Ghana, I guess. Like in the past, when I've been going to Guinea, I've always gone through Ghana anyway. Usually it wasn't getting off the airplane though. But so getting to Ghana, you go from Melbourne to Dubai to Accra, is the capital of Ghana. Okay. But then to get to Guinea, capital is Conakry. Every time I go there from this side, we fly to Accra, then to like the capital of Cote d'Ivoire, then which is Abidjan, then to the capital of Togo, which is Lomé, and then to Conakry. And it's always like the same airplane takes off from Accra, and a few passengers get on and off at Abidjan and a few more get on and off at Lome. And so it's like being on kind of a bus.
Yes. That is, well, that's awesome. To be on a plane, everyone would be very envious of that. So you arrived in Ghana, were there in Ghana for 3 weeks. So tell us, so you got off the plane. What did you get up to? Tell us all about the, what you're up to.
Yeah. So the big picture was, this was a project funded by the German government, the German Development Agencies, GIZ is the acronym, in partnership with QSI, which is a major food testing lab in Europe. And they were both interested in getting the Ghanaian honey fit for export. The project name had the very imaginative name of Make Ghanaian Honey Fit for Export Project. And there's lots of beekeepers who were fairly good at what they're doing already, but the honey wasn't quite measuring up to the food standard, food quality standards that they wanted to do in Europe. And so what we did in the project is each week we were in a different place, so three different places. Each time we had between 50 and 70 trainees who by and large were experienced beekeepers already with pretty much 100% top bar hives. And so we were talking about common construction problems with top bar hives, as well as best management of harvesting the honey. One thing that even here I'm always emphasizing a lot is, in a lot of these places, because even here they were harvesting their honey at night frequently, and then you can't see what you're pulling out. So these people, even if they know better, they can't see what they're doing. So they're pulling out brood and they're pulling out uncapped honey. And that was kind of the main thing that's affecting the main purpose of the project. That's what's causing the quality issues. But then as well, addressing the quality of the hives issues, the common problems with top bar hives, also can increase their output. But obviously, so those were kind of the two major focuses.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Just to jump in on there. So is there a reason why they're inspecting them at nighttime? Is that a temperature related?
Yes. Oh, and that's what I was about to get into as well. And they're always saying, and especially before we went out the first time, they were saying, well, we can't do what you're saying because our bees are too badly tempered. They're too aggressive. We cannot do it during the day. And I heard this in Nigeria, and I've heard this in Guinea and everywhere else I've been in Africa. So I'm asking like, yeah, let me show you. But I was in for a surprise because these other African countries had made me kind of complacent, I guess. I quickly became convinced that Ghanaian bees are a lot more aggressive than even the other African bees that I've dealt with. Usually in Guinea and other places I've been to, it's not that big of a deal. I show them we can do beekeeping. They're, oh, okay, we can do that. But like the first three days that we had field visits, the first day we were just going to go look at some hives and not even open them. And while looking at the hives, the bees started stinging us and we had to kind of make a retreat and they were chasing us away. And I was like, all right, but you know, you'll get a random fluke of a bad-tempered hive. So I was like, all right, well, that was the whole thing. And then the next day was our first day of actually opening the hives. And some of the experienced beekeepers were adamantly trying to talk me out of it, saying, no, you can't do this. And I was being stubborn and saying, no, we're going to do this. And so we opened three hives with groups of 5 to 7 trainees. The first two, easy peasy. I was able to take off my glove and put it on the hive full of bees. But look, these bees are not as bad as you think they are. And everyone's like, oh, yeah. Then the third hive, which was actually the one that chased me the day before, and as we're going up to it, the guy whose yard it was like, you don't want to open that hive. You don't want to open that hive. But I can get really stubborn. I was like,
yes.
This is the next in line. I'm not going to work around it. I'm going to work the hives in the line I plan on doing it. And they quickly became extremely stingy. And so they were chasing away, like the people that were like 200 meters away who were, you know, waiting for their turn. They all had to retreat. One of our trainees I guess the zipper wasn't coming. She started getting bees in her veil. So she had to like evacuate herself. Like it was kind of a fiasco. But again, I'm being stubborn. I'm like, if I like abort this now, it's going to give them the message that you can't do this. So even with people running for their lives, I'm still like, we're going to power through this. And so we did. But then we had to walk around for like 45 minutes afterwards until the last people had few enough bees trying to sting them that they could exit the area. And so that was kind of a fiasco. Then the third day, once again, we were not going to open any hives. Like, okay, the bees are still too angry at that other site, but we're going to go look at some bees at another site. I'm like, all right, okay, fine. And so we go to this area. It's like a short drive out of town. And we walk like 500 meters or something to where these bees are. And again, we're just looking at these hives this time. And once again, we're walking around and there's just two or three hives under a mango tree surrounded by peanut fields. And just looking at them, the bees start stinging everyone.
Wow.
And everyone starts running away. And like I said, I can be very stubborn, and having been in commercial beekeeping for 20 years, for me, it's like a point of pride that I do not run from bees.
Yes.
If the bees are stinging me, everyone else is smarter than me and ran. And I'm walking at a brisk pace away. And pretty soon I had, my face was covered in bees trying to sting me.
No way.
My face and the back of my neck. And finally, I'm like, I'm going to have to run. This is just getting worse.
No way.
I'm going to have to swallow my pride and run. And so took off my glasses and ran for about 200 meters. And that was enough to not have bees trying to sting me anymore. But at that point, I was like, I think I've been wrong about these bees here in Ghana. But after that, we made sure to generally only open the hives within the last hour of daylight and only in areas that there aren't other people working. And so for the rest of the 3 weeks, we didn't have any incidents like that because they got me to stop being stubborn and work around the angry bees. And I think they did in the end take the message that, okay, we can actually open these hives in the daylight if we, you know, do it towards the end of the day, not around working people, you know, deal with the fact that the bees are bad tempered. So I did definitely learn that lesson.
that is so interesting. And so opening the hives up that last hour before sunset, it really makes a difference as far as their disposition?
Well, it does. And then, well, and that was my inclination. But then the other thing we did, and the local beekeepers were convinced the bees would be more docile in the morning, which is not an observation I think I've ever made. I don't know. But so we actually ended up opening a lot of hives like at 9 a.m., which, you know, and to a certain degree, I can only push everyone around so much when they want to do something. And they were convinced the bees are angry because they're opening in the afternoon. We need to open them in the morning. And so we did end up opening a lot of hives at like between 7 and 9 a.m. every morning, and it wasn't that bad. And so I don't know if it's true that their bees, or maybe all bees, are more nice at 9 a.m. or if it just, we didn't have any more really angry bees anymore. I'm not sure.
That's so interesting. And also too, Chris, you just mentioned about the quality of the honey for export into Europe, and obviously touch base on, you know, there's some brood that's harvested with it. So can you talk us through that? You know, why it wasn't sort of 100% up to standard for export?
Yeah, the specific thing was some testing came back saying there was too much smoke in the honey, which actually caused a bit of a misconception, because I had beekeepers saying, oh, I don't use a smoker because the lab tests are saying we're getting too much smoke in the honey. But I think the reason for that wasn't because anyone was blowing their smoker too much. It's that when people are harvesting their hive at night, sometimes they literally just light a fire under the hive and drive the bees out and take all the honey. So I don't think it was a smoker problem. It was people doing this traditional methods of harvesting by just literally burning the bees out of the hives. And so that was the main thing that had come back from some testing, but there was a lot of honey that still hadn't been tested. From my own visual observation, I tasted honey that tasted somewhat fermented, which would be a water content, unripe honey being harvested problem. And I also saw a lot of honey that visually I could tell was more cloudy than I would like to see it. And so that's why I've kind of, problems are unripe honey and harvesting brood is what gives you that really cloudy honey typically.
Interesting. And obviously we touched base on, spoke about it with the floral types back in episode 94, but what particular floral species were there at the moment, like when they were foraging? What was that sort of main nectar?
Well, so in Ghana, there were lots of commercial plantations. So we had some of the hives were on mango plantations. They had shea butter tree or shea trees, I guess, plantations. And so in Ghana, you'd have a lot of people locating them next to one of these commercial crop plantations. In Guinea, it was mainly just kind of miscellaneous forest honey. So it was a bit more miscellaneous over there in Guinea.
Interesting. And what about the language barrier? Obviously got you know, a bunch of trainees. Do they speak English or do you have a translator there?
No, and it was kind of a headache because in Ghana, at two of our three sites at least, the locals were groups of people that spoke two different languages. And so I had to have two translators. And for me, that was much more frustrating than, you know, it's bad enough having one translator, you speak, gotta wait for them, speak, gotta wait for them. But now having two translators, I speak, the translator speaks, and the second translator speaks. And often the second translator, even though they both of them understand English, I have a feeling probably the second translator was also influenced by what the first translator said. And so we got a kind of game of telephone where if the first translator kind of misinterpreted something I said, he'd explain it. And then the second translator listening to him would either be like, oh, maybe that's the correct interpretation, or that's more fresh in my memory when I'm start talking. So I'm going to say that instead of what Chris said. So sometimes, you know, sometimes just through their gestures and things, you can kind of get a feel for what they're saying. And sometimes I'm like, I'm not sure he's saying what I wanted him to say.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting challenge. And what about, obviously, we've both got Latina partners from South America. So I can say this. So were you the only gringo there, Chris?
No. So in Ghana, I had one of the representatives from the German organization.
Okay.
There, this guy Arne. In Guinea, I was the only one. And it was interesting. So Arne, who's the German guy who brought me onto this is also a story about the power of networking, because I had just kind of on my own wicket gone to. In the off years, Apomondia has regional symposiums. And in 2014, I think, I heard somewhere that there was a regional symposium for Apomondia in Africa, in Tanzania. And so no organization sent me or anything. I just like, that'll be fun. And I went. And Arne was one of the people I met there. And then years later, he needs a beekeeping trainer. And he remembered me and emailed me 2 or 3 months before this. Was like, hey, would you like to go do this thing? Let me close the window. Yeah, getting too much sun on me. Oh, there we go.
That's a good problem to have. Too much sun now because it's been a bit cold late.
For a moment. But yeah, so the power of networking is how I got on this project, basically.
That's awesome. That's absolutely so cool. So and
it was funny too because I'm fairly tall and Arne was even taller than me. So I think we left them with the impression that white folks must all be really tall because the two of us were like a head taller than everyone else. It's kind of funny.
That's so interesting. There you go. And what about obviously the safety components? You know, I mean, you sort of mentioned touch base on Guinea being a little bit dicey. Talk us like what sort of safety concerns do you have? You know, I mean, being over there.
Yeah, and I have kind of a reckless disregard for personal safety. I've done a lot of projects that people previous to me had refused to do. This one, and like Ghana's fairly safe, but while I was there, monkeypox is, you know, in the news. That's like ground zero for monkeypox. There was like an outbreak of Marburg virus, which is related to Ebola, in Ghana while I was there, not near where I was. And then there was an outbreak of polio, of all things, while I was there somewhere too. So it's funny, one of my friends asked me, oh, did you see the news about the disease in Ghana? And I was like, was it polio, Marburg, or monkeypox? Wow. They're like, Jesus. But so none of those were actually near me. So they kind of made the news and could make it sound scary, but none of them were near me. I felt very safe in Ghana, really. In Guinea, it was a bit... I know. Well, it was weird because so Guinea currently has a military dictatorship. And so the organization that sent me to Guinea, they had hired or contracted with a security consulting firm that sent me daily security updates. And every day it was like, do not travel in the capital if you can avoid it.
Wow.
Avoid these areas at all costs. Because, yeah, so they've got a military dictatorship and they've got people protesting it, but they're cracking down strongly on those protests. And so mostly I wasn't in the capital. But when I was seeing these news stories, like, this is kind of dicey. It seems like there could be, like, a revolution at any moment, and it's probably not good to be caught up in it. But other than that, I didn't feel too unsafe, really. It was pretty good, though.
so it's okay, like getting around at nighttime? Is that not a really concern?
In Guinea, so in Ghana, yeah, I didn't really have any reason to go anywhere at night, but I don't think I would have been too afraid. Ghana felt very safe. In Guinea, when I was in the rural areas, I felt perfectly fine. Go walk around in the evening and all that. Definitely in the capital of Guinea, in Conakry, you don't go out at night. And I don't want to get the Guinean government after me, but like your biggest threat is the police.
Interesting.
Like when I first arrived, they were like, there's a police station down at the corner of the block. Don't go over there if you want to avoid trouble.
Wow.
And I don't want to get on any Guinean watch lists, but like definitely the police and the military in uniform kind of looked like they were spoiling for a fight every time I saw them.
Yes, I think I know where you're heading with that one. Does it involve money? An extortion?
And then I had them kind of trying to strong arm bribes out of me.
Yes.
Numerous times, including like in the airport trying to leave Guinea. I had someone in a police uniform ask me how much money I was carrying. And that's sometimes a standard question because you need to declare if you have, over $10,000. But I was like, why? And what I found is in other countries, because corruption's a thing in a lot of countries, but in other countries, they've kind of jokingly tried to be, oh, you got a bribe for me? But this wasn't the first time this happened to me in Guinea, where she's making it sound like an official inquiry, like, and how much money do you have on you? And I'm like, why? And she's like, oh, you have something small for me. And then I'm like, no. And then like 3 meters away, like I take like 5 steps, there's another person in police uniform. And once again, they're like, do you have any money? And I'm like, no. And then, when you just tell them flat out, no, they're okay, this guy's not about to come up with money. But, and then they let you go. But definitely, and so they were pretty easygoing. In the past, I've actually been held up by, like at gunpoint practically, by uniformed people in Guinea. Corruption is a problem
there. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Wow. That was amazing. What an incredible experience, all those dealing with that. Now, you touch base on some, obviously, with the production of the beehives. So talk us through that. Obviously, getting that timber, is it, recycled? Is it purpose-built timber to create the hives?
Yeah, typically they have made out of planks. Typically, the beekeepers themselves aren't making the beehives, but they're hiring local carpenters to do it. But definitely kind of what I've ended up doing is I kind of at the beginning of my trainings, I always ask them, someone share with the rest of the class where you get your beehives, because at least someone will be like, oh, there's this carpenter that does it really well and stuff. And so I kind of encourage them to share amongst each other who the best carpenter to make beehives is. And so I do go through, here's how you make a hive. And then obviously I go through a lot of here's common problems with hives, because it's a lot of common problems with the top bar hives. The most common thing is they make them the wrong width, and then there's lots of cross combing. So I do that with the top bar hives. And then same thing again, I ask who has a smoker, and like 3 people raise their hand. I'm like, okay, one of you who has smokers, raise your hand. Who sold you that smoker? And then they'll say who's making smokers in the area. And same thing again with the protective clothing, usually is, 10 to 20% of them actually have protective gear, which is obviously a big problem. And so I both have someone share with the class where you're getting this, who locally is making this, and then we also go through a very simple way of making it in the presentation.
That's interesting.
Because these are the major obstacles to kind of more modern beekeeping.
I was going to ask that, like the smoker, is someone supplying the smokers, or are they being made there?
Yeah, well, and that's always been something I felt kind of awkward about, because most of the other things I can teach them how to make it, but I don't know how to make a smoker. And I haven't found a good slideshow presentation on how to make a smoker. But fortunately, in all of these places, there's usually someone that does. Necessity is the mother of invention. Like,
yes.
Throughout Africa, there's people that are very crafty with making things and stuff. And so there's local tinsmiths that will knock together the you know, can part of the smoker and all that, and then put the leather on the bellows. The fun trick, I've never even opened a bellows, but I assume there was a spring in there. But I asked someone how they did it. They're like, oh, I just put a rubber ball in the bellows, and then it
love bellows.
It. I'm like, oh, that's a good idea.
Absolutely love it.
Yeah. So there's this cool stuff like that.
And Chris, what about your downtime when you're not with the bees? What are you getting up to?
It's funny because I felt like I had very little downtime in Ghana. Well, first of all, they worked me like 12 hours a day or more.
Okay.
So we'd from yes. morning until like 6 p.m. They were getting their money's worth out of me. And then usually, and especially this was actually good because usually I do kind of one course for one group and then it's, you know, months, if not a year before I do another one. So I might think of what I wished I had in the presentation, but then I procrastinate fixing it until I maybe never do. But because this time I had kind of three in a row real quick, every day I'd come up against the slides I wished I had, the part of my presentation I wished was better. And so typically in the evening I was working on my presentation to fix it up. And when I wasn't doing that, and oh, the other thing that was really fun is, and often these projects in the past, it's just been me and one translator. But for this, we had like a team of like five or six of us, and they were all kind of all in their early to mid 30s. And they were just really, really great. One young woman and some young men. And so we'd just be hanging out for a lot. I'm reading books a lot. It is kind of a slower lifestyle in general. I spend a lot of time just sitting around talking to people, which I think is fun. I like kind of old ways of doing things.
Yeah, that's love it. Absolutely love it. And what about, obviously, in both countries, in Ghana and Guinea, are they actually, you know, are these beekeepers wanting to get into beekeeping to produce honey to make an income? Is this sort of that main project as to what the outcome wants to be?
Yeah, I've always thought of it as a supplemental income because a lot of these people are spacing on the word. They're just growing enough crops to support their family, really. And then they think it just, you know, they're trying to farm like a quarter acre, and then a beehive or two on that quarter acre significantly increases their income compared to what they're making otherwise. But then another really interesting thing about this whole thing was I first went to Guinea 8 years ago in 2014. And I went back to that same place now 8 years later, and they actually have people that are working full time at beekeeping, which I kind of thought wasn't about to happen there. Like I assumed everyone was a farmer and then beekeeping on the side, but they got into beekeeping in such a big way that there's people that just do beekeeping in that village now. And when I first arrived, they were producing 1 to 2 tons of honey, and now they're producing 7 to 10 tons of honey.
That's awesome.
And really getting to the quality issue again, like they showed me a bottle of their honey and it was just very clear, like really nice looking honey. And then they showed me a bottle of some other honey from the local market and it was very cloudy. And especially things like that, I'm very cynical and I don't like flatter myself thinking I'm doing, like I'm thinking, I'm doing all this, but they're just shaking their head and going back to what they were doing before. And so when I see this like clear evidence of they are producing a lot more honey, their honey is a lot clearer than their neighbors. Like it just really blows my mind. Like I did that. Like
that's awesome. Wow. Love it. Absolutely love that. Because one of the main exports out of those two countries is the shea butter, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Well, especially in Ghana. Yeah.
Especially in Ghana. And well, the bees, I'm not familiar with that particular tree, but I believe it's a nut of sorts. Is that correct? Is it a type of nut?
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
And do the bees work those flowers?
Yeah. Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Wow.
So they get a lot of bees visiting the shea butter trees, yeah.
That's really cool because there's actually on YouTube, there's Business Insider, and there's a couple of really good videos on the production of shea butter, which is an amazing, amazing ingredient.
Yeah, and it's interesting because apparently traditionally, just by tradition, they don't cut down the shea trees. And so throughout the region, especially in the north, like I said, there's lots of cropped land that is typically either peanuts or cassava that is kind of hooed by hand and all that. And then there's these shade trees right in the middle of it, because they don't, you know, you don't, they don't clear the land to plant the crops. They just plant around the shade tree, okay, because the shade tree makes a good crop of shea nuts. And so there's lots of these trees all around, just like heaps of them, because they just crop around them.
Absolutely awesome. Now, obviously we spoke about some challenges, but what was a couple of highlights of the trip over there, Chris?
I think definitely by far the highlight was, like I said, I went back to this village 8 years later, and, you know, there was this one kid who was six when I was there, and he like used to climb all over me. And he, when I'd come back from the day of working, he'd come up and grab the smoker and be holding the smoker. And he was just really into it. And so he was six then. Now he's 13. And so it was really fun to see him again, as well as, you know, all the other kids and all that. And yeah, his brother was, I guess, 13, I think, when I was there before, and now he's 21. And he was really excited to see me too. And so it's just really fun to see these people 8 years later. And kids grow so much in 8 years. But then another interesting thing that I'm kind of torn about is, so one thing I like about going there is I like the slower lifestyle, like how you spend the evening kind of talking on the porches. And especially when I was in this village, Sen Piring, the first time, every evening we'd all just sit on the porch talking. It's just starlight above us and the glowing coals from the little fire they're boiling tea on. Now, this time, 8 years later, we sat inside and watched TV. And so it's kind of, I feel a little bit torn, because absolutely their life has improved. They would prefer to sit at home and watch TV than sit out in the starlight. And so I have to appreciate that their life is better. But at the same time, what made me like being there, I'm kind of destroying by my development.
That's so interesting. That's, yeah, I can really appreciate that, because there's, yeah, that's a very interesting thing to ponder, isn't it? To actually have a TV,
as opposed to, I did this, and they're better off, but it's not what I liked.
Interesting. I really appreciate that. That's really, very, very interesting. And And then what about next trip? What's any more trips on the horizon?
There was some discussion of me going back to Guinea to do a beekeeping project for a university there. That sounds very exciting. One thing that's very definitely pretty much 100% is the project in Ghana is a 3-year project. So we do plan on definitely doing it next year. End of April, May, basically, as soon as I'm freer from work down here. And I'm really looking forward to that, because it'll presumably be the same team of people I was going around with this last time. And I'm really, you know, we became good friends by the end of that. And I'm really looking forward to going back there with them.
That's so cool. And you're all ready for our spring bee season, Chris?
Yeah. Getting ready for it.
I know it's around the
corner. Looking forward to the season beginning.
Exactly. I know it's around the corner. I think we've got a nice 2 days next week. I think we believe 19 degrees Celsius, which is going to be absolute awesome.
Yeah. I heard about the first swarm of the year the other day. Of course, so I run my own bees and I also work for Edmunds Honey. And it's funny, because people come in and, you know, they mention everything that's going on. And someone came in saying, "Hey, I caught a swarm. I need a box." And I was like, "You're the first one."
Interesting.
And so that was for people that are putting pins in the maps about this, that was in St. Leonard's in kind of southeast Geelong, first swarm that I know of the season.
Wow, there you go. That's interesting. Well, that absolute awesome. That was fantastic to sort of talk to you again, Chris. And just before we close up, now your own podcast, I'll get you to shout that out to all the listeners, to people who want to listen to.
Yeah, so it is called the Agronautica. I should have reviewed this. As I was saying before, I haven't really done anything with it in a while. But I think if you Google into wherever podcasts are, Agronautica, like Agrinautica, I think that should bring it up. Unless it's the Appenautica. It might be the Appenautica.
Okay, well, I was going to say.
Which would be API.
Have you done any episodes? Have you done any new episodes yourself?
No, yeah, I had big plans of, oh, it would be really cool to record an episode while I was there in Africa this time. And I kept thinking about it. I kept thinking about to do it. And it was funny. So one of the guys that was on our team that was going around, this guy, Williams, he interviewed me for a podcast or some kind of thing they were doing there. And I was like, I'm going to interview in return. But that never happened. So I got interviewed by him for something, but I never got around to interview. So I didn't make a new episode, basically.
That's right. Well, so for the listeners, so definitely check it out. So if you go into this podcast, go to episode 94, and it's all in those show notes to listen, because it's really, really cool to actually listen to. So
yeah, go to the show notes. And then also what I can plug is BAID International on Facebook, which I'm not good at social media. I don't know if I've updated that much lately either, but that's where, if I'm going to update anything pertaining to this, I'm going to post it there.
Okay, awesome. So BAID International. Awesome. Yeah. We'll have to definitely check that out. Chris, mate, that I am so envious and jealous. That sounds like an awesome, awesome trip. And thank you so much for the update. It was really, really cool to have a chat again. Absolutely awesome.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
No worries, Chris. Well, you take care, and we will look forward to when you go overseas again in the not too distant future. And thank you so much for your time. That was absolutely amazing.
No problem.
No worries. Well, you take care, and look forward to catching up. All the best.
Sounds good.
Wow. Thank you so much, Chris. That was absolutely awesome. Thank you so much for your time. Hearing about your recent travels is so, so cool. And I'm so looking forward to doing some traveling soon. That's usually my downtime is winter. And I like to go hop on a plane, because how cool is it hopping on a plane? And just off air, it was kind of funny, because I was just saying thanks to Chris, and he mentioned after being during COVID for the last 2.5 years, hearing the noise, that noise on a plane of that seatbelt going on, that little noise, as that light comes up and that noise. And that was so, so cool and so funny. So awesome. Thank you so much, Chris. And thank you all the listeners. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time. And looking forward to the next week, next episode. And don't forget, take care of yourself, take care of each other, and take care of those bees. Bye for now.